Welcome to episode 72 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Curtis Blaze, host of the Better Off Dead Minute and the upcoming Time Bandits Minute. Welcome to the show, Curtis.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. We've had fun on other recordings, so I figured, you know, might as well, you know, try to get you in here also. So hopefully we'll have a fun time.
You were in this, as we're recording this, you were just on Time Bandits.
Yes, last week. Yes, that's true. That's very true. I just get deja vu thinking about us recording this episode. Yeah.
I wonder why.
I don't know. I can't figure that out. No clue whatsoever. Episode 72 begins with Henley informing Werner to stop looking for his wallet, and goes all the way till Henley continues. He comments on how mixed up a kid Werner is. Yesterday's episode, we basically discussed the fact that Werner came across the fact that he was missing his wallet, which, as we all know, was a nice sleight of hand of Henley a few weeks ago, where he pilfered it, and they were able to get all those fun documents from there. However long it is, he finally realized that he's missing his wallet, and he figures that it must be in Henley and Blythe's room. So he comes into there, tries to start looking for it. Henley, as we know, Henley did this all on purpose in order to be able to blackmail him into giving them something. He basically starts off this minute by saying to Werner, all right, I'll look for it. It's going to look a little suspicious if anyone sees the two of us, you know, probing around at this time of night. So, I mean, it's a great line, because the way that Henley delivers it is, I mean, since we know his real motivations here, it's just very tongue-in-cheek the way he says it. You know, he's like, you know, I'm going to find it. You just get out of here. And I don't need you to find it, basically, is what he's saying. Because, as we know, and he says that, I'll find it, I promise you, I'll find it even if I have to tear the whole room apart. Which, he's sort of letting the cat out of the bag because of the way he's saying it. You know, he's basically, you know, as we know, he knows where the wallet is. So, by saying it the way that he's saying it, just comes off quite interestingly, because Werner doesn't get it. Wonder if, do you think it has to do with the fact that the language issue, or just he's a little bit of an adult?
A couple of your words cut out there, so I wasn't sure what you're asking, but you know, Werner is just being used by them, right? Mm-hmm. He's not participating.
No.
It's interesting to me that he's the weasel when he's not actually participating in the scheme. Or the ferret. I'm sorry, the ferret.
Ferret, weasel. You know, there's not much of a difference between the two, is there?
Well, the ferret seems nicer. The ferret seems like something that like goes around grabbing things. The weasel seems like there's some evil intent there.
Right, but the ferret, this guy, the ferret is a term for the German guards. That's what that was one of the slang terms used by the prisoners for the guards.
That was historic. Ferrets. Nice.
I
didn't know that. Wow,
yes.
That's a whole conversation that we could have right there about how they felt about the German guards. Did the why ferret? Do you suppose? Is that something you've looked up? Is that something you've already discussed with someone?
I haven't discussed it with anyone, if I remember correctly. I did look it up. There was a reason that they called them ferrets.
Well, that's fine. I'm just wondering, because I love this movie so much, and you seem to just be the authority. It's like, oh, I've got this opportunity now with Rob to find out everything I've ever wanted to know about this movie.
Well, you have to listen to the whole podcast for that. Wait, okay. Are you looking for a shortcut here, Curtis? Is that what you're saying here?
I'm gonna listen to all 187 minutes.
172. Don't go. 172 plus a bonus episode. How's that?
Awesome. This guard, Werner. Does he know? Do you think he knows he's being used?
No, I don't think he does.
It seems like he's playing it that he doesn't know he's being used. What are the exact documents that they're getting off of him here?
They got travel passports. They got a travel permit. They were actually able to get off of him a timetable of all the guards, you know, when they're on their shifts and things like that. They got a copy of what a train ticket looks like. I mean, there are a lot of things that they got off of him. They basically said that he struck gold by finding this particular wallet because there was so much stuff in there.
So then they're going to start making copies of all this stuff for the escapers.
Correct.
But they need a camera in the first place in order to make copies of it. They don't have that yet. And that's what the scene is
about. Yeah, the scene is all about the idea of them finding a way to get a copy, to find out, you know, how they can get a camera in order to take pictures of all of the prisoners.
So Renner needs to bring a camera back and then and then they'll take pictures of the documents before he gets his wallet back with all of the stuff in it.
Correct. No, I mean they don't need to take a picture of the documents themselves. They need to take pictures of the prisoners in order to use them.
Oh, okay. It's somebody
in order to put their pictures on the various documents.
Got it. That means somebody is like an artist is hand drawing these things or fashioning these things.
Blythe and his whole crew, their job is basically making sure that they can copy all of these permits by hand, or maybe they're using some sort of typewriter. I mean, that I don't know for part of them. I mean, there is a point in the future where we see that someone brings over a document that they did by hand. They're very good artists. But what they're missing is the camera, and that's what, as you said, that's what this whole scene is. You know, they found a way to blackmail one of the guards by stealing his wallet, so that they're asking him to get them a camera. So I mean, the scene continues. You know, Henley just said right now to Werner, "Go away." Basically, I'm gonna take care of finding your wallet, and then he sits down back at his chess game because he and Blythe are sitting and playing chess, and Blythe then points to one of his pieces, which is what he actually just moved in order, you know, while Henley was dealing with Werner at the time. You know, he just wants to let him know which piece, because I think he said he had him in check right beforehand. So he had to move to move his king out of the way. I love the hand signals, because Blythe points to his king, and at that point, Henley points to his cheek. Now, is he scratching himself? Or is it something that he's looking, you know, is he signaling back something? Obviously, we'll never know, but it looks like he might be signaling. You know, that doesn't look that natural with the way he's doing it. Right. He's like pointing under his eye type of thing.
Like, is this the motion?
Well, since this is not video, I can see what you're doing, but no one else can.
No,
but yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yes.
Well,
but you probably should explain to people what you just did.
I'm describing.
Curtis just poked at his eye.
Is he? What I'm asking is he putting his finger underneath his eye and like pointing like this, you know, and like pointing at his eye from his
cheek? I believe
cheek?
That's what he's doing. Yes.
That means a thing.
That means I don't actually believe you. Usually, that means you're full of crap, or whoever's talking is.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Okay.
Maybe he's saying to Blythe, "I'm full of crap," you know, not you know. They continue their game, and then Werner screams, "Thank you," and the response from Henley is, "Forget it, don't worry about it." And then Werner leaves, and as the door's about to shut, he goes, "Werner, yes," and he goes, "I'm gonna need one small favor from you. I need a camera." And he says it so nonchalantly. You know, he's just sitting there looking at the board. And he goes, "I need a camera." And the way that Werner's jaw just drops is great. I mean, the acting here is just superb. It is, you know, he's...
Oh, for sure. At this point, Robert Graf, Werner, knows he's been compromised.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's smiling, and then immediately his facial expression changes completely. And he's dumbfounded. He basically just says, "I've just been hooked," and like his, and you can see his eyes sort of popping out also at the same time. So it's definitely a great scene. Yes, what were you saying, Curtis?
I don't like to be tricked. I'm not a fan of that at all. I feel like if I was Werner and I realized, because it's obvious, you know, from Mr. Graff's acting that he's realizing that he's now being taken for a ride, I would definitely at this point not put up with their crap. I feel like I would start tearing apart them.
Yeah, but he realizes that he doesn't have that option. Because if he tears up the room and someone else finds out that he's tearing up the room, so then the question will be asked,
how did he lose his wallet?
What were you doing there? He says, well, I was, you know, what is he going to say? I suspected they were building a tunnel there, and at the same time, I found my wallet. Because we don't know if the wallet is in the room. My assumption is it's not in the room. My assumption is that right now his wallet and all the documents are with the other forgers.
Spread out across
the camp, that all the different forgers are doing their work, copying these documents as well as possible. I mean, you got to remember, they didn't have photocopy machines back then. Or even stenography
machines. Yeah, what a dilemma.
What were those ones called?
What a dilemma to be
in. What were the ones called where
Did they even have mimeograph machines back then?
I don't know. What I was thinking is, you know, have you ever seen the movie Teachers?
Yes.
Okay, so there's one teacher who is constantly making dittos, right? Then the teacher's name is Ditto, and he has that machine that you crank, and the paper goes through it, and it makes copies of all that. I remember in high school, in elementary school and high school, the teachers always used those.
Yeah, the 70s and 80s, those were mimeograph machines.
Right.
They smelled great. I loved them.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll never forget the smell of the ink from those things. Mm. Boy, when you really think about this movie, when you really start thinking about this movie, they had to make their own ink from somewhere or get their ink from somewhere. Like, how do they? It's a way to ask.
How did they get ink?
How did they get stuff into the camp at all? Was the situation?
Ah, well, we're going to talk about that shortly. I got a lot to say about that, about how they snuck a lot of things into the camp.
Sneaking things in, okay. So they were sneaking things in.
But there were stuff.
This movie.
There's.
But they were making stuff too.
The compasses they made themselves. You know, they get like little pieces of mercury and create compasses. You know, makeshift compasses for the whole thing.
Sure.
The ink itself, I can't tell you how they made it. That I wasn't able to figure out. So they must have found a way to steal it in very high proportions in order to be able to use it.
Just stole it from... Just whenever Hogan would go into Colonel Klink's office, he'd swipe a bottle of it.
Exactly. Now, I wonder if you can make your own ink, you know, by... I'm trying to think of if there's something that they might have used in order to make their own ink. Yeah.
Well, it's always been... I mean, you know, people crush flowers and mix it with water and alcohol and whatever. I mean, making ink seems like a pretty rudimentary thing.
Okay, so maybe that's how they did it then.
I'm just wondering, like, what plausible way they would have used to make black ink. Okay, here's the ingredients for making black ink at home. Ready?
Yes.
A tablespoon of lamp black. You can make yourself by holding a plate over a candle and collecting the soot.
Okay.
An egg yolk, a teaspoon of gum arabic, which is just, you know, I don't know what that is, but there's probably some. Okay, I have to know what gum arabic is.
Okay, so in other words, it's not so trivial.
Yeah, it's something they could have
just... It's not so trivial for them to do this. They would know how to do it quite simply.
Yeah, and I get the feeling, you know, people that were in the army back then were coming out of... There was a lot higher percentage of people coming from... the Boy Scouts and organizations like that, where they would have learned these things.
The Boy Scouts,
learned how to do these
things. Do they teach you how to make ink in the Boy Scouts? That's not something I would think of. I mean, a few weeks ago, we had a whole discussion about, you know, the merit badges between Henley and Werner when they first met up.
Yeah.
I don't recall them mentioning anything about, you know, getting an ink badge. But you're right. But also, people back in the 30s and 40s, they needed to make more things on their own. You know, even...
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, when you're getting your badge for making stamps, like, that's one of the badges you get is, you know, you carve your own stamp out of a piece of wood and then you know, a block printer thing. It would be plausible, I would think, back then, rather than buying expensive ink... to just make something.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, even if it was as simple as mixing soot with water and a little bit of honey to give it some stand-up stuff, and you know, and then and making it. It just seems like people back then, especially scouts, were probably a lot more self or just proficient.
Right, but I'm not even talking about just scouts. I'm saying anyone in general. If you, you know, someone living in a backwater town in Arkansas, right? That's where you're from. you know, back then, they, you know, you're not necessarily going to go buy everything in the general store. So it's possible that, you know, you'd find a way to make your own ingredients for things and then use those skills later in life.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, for sure, Americans were 15 years out of that, roughly 15 years out of that, or even 10, 41, whatever, out of the Great Depression, where people didn't have stuff and they just had to make it if they wanted
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Alcohol. I mean, like some sophisticated things, because alcohol could kill you if you made it wrong, and people weren't dying that often.
I think alcohol can kill you if you make it right also.
Only the right amounts.
Exactly. Right. Okay.
So fun times. I mean, this whole scheme, this whole movie, this whole scheme is just amazing. It's just so fun to watch.
So moving along, we get Henley actually tells him why he needs a camera. We want to take some snapshots, you know, to have some keepsakes from living in the, you know, living in this camp. So he needs a 35mm camera with a 2.8 lens and a plain shutter. And, you know,
these things.
One second. One second. We'll get there in a second. And then they show Werner's face, his jaw dropping even further down, trying to realize that he's very much being wrangled in right now. At this point, Blythe corrects Henley and says, no, we need something with a focal plane shutter, not just a shutter. So he then says to Werner, oh, Werner, we need a focal plane shutter. Now, I know that you have a background in photography, so maybe you can explain to people who are very ignorant like me, who have no idea what a focal plane shutter is, or what type of shutters there are. So why don't you enlighten us? Or enlighten me.
Well,
I'm the only person in the world who doesn't know. So everyone else is intelligent. Everyone else knows this. I'm the one person who doesn't. So go ahead. Explain to me what it is, please, Curtis.
Let me first start off by saying that I'm not sure why they need this highly technical camera in order to just take snapshots of people for documents. They really are. They're asking for a very good camera. And people that go and buy fancy cameras now at a Best Buy or whatever, they're not getting a camera that's this good in 2020. They're getting a...
Wait a second. There's, what about 2021?
2020. Did I say 2002?
No, you said 2020. You said 2020, but you know, we're beyond 2020 already.
I don't know. It just feels like we're repeating it over and over again. It's been a long year.
Yes.
So people now, when they go out to buy cameras, aren't getting lenses this good. I mean, they're getting a focal plane shutter because that's a thing, and I'll explain that here in a second. But as far as lenses go, that 2.8 measurement is a measurement of how much light comes in, and the smaller the number is, like to a person just looking at a camera who doesn't know photography, the bigger the lens is, the bigger around the lens is. Because the smaller that number is, the more light gets in.
Okay.
So when you've got like a 2.8, you've got a pretty hefty camera with a lot of glass in it that lets a lot of light in. Right now, when people go to a Best Buy and they buy themselves a fancy camera, they're buying lenses with a number of that says 4.5 on it, which is a huge difference from a 2.8. So all that to say, they're really asking for a pretty fancy camera for this time period.
Well, maybe because they need the pictures to be of a good enough quality because they're going on official documents. Could that be?
I mean, yeah, it could be. It all depends on your exposure, because there's the exposure triangle. You have your light and you have your ISO, which back then would have been film speed, and you have that F number, that F stop number. And if they, I know. So if they really needed to, they could have taken a much less, a lower quality camera and just exposed it for longer to get enough light to make it look good. But all that's beside the point. They're getting this amazing camera, which was just invented less than 100 years ago at this point, like in 1889.
What do you mean? It's not even 100. He's not asking, even 100 years. What are you talking about? That's 60 years even. No, it's 50 years.
That's what I said. Less than 100 years 50, ago.
50. It's been 50 years. If we're now in 44, right. So yeah, it's 55 years or whatever it is. Wow.
Yep. Before 55 years before this, they didn't have a type of thing called a focal plane shutter. They had a what's it called? It's like a daisy. What am I trying to say? It's the kind of, when you think about shutters on cameras, there's a, what is the name for it?
When you think about shutters on the camera? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm talking about shutters on the camera. I know, I'm sorry. I just need 1 second to
come on, I don't even here. Know what a focal plane shutter is. You think I know what they're using on cameras now?
Okay, well, I'll describe it this way. Whenever you see pictures being taken in movies, what happens is you've got a circle in the center, and that circle opens up and then shuts. Are you aware of that effect when they're pretending? That was the kind of shutter that they used to have. It used to be built right into the lenses. And what happened with that is that the light in the center of the picture got more light than on the edges because it opened up, and as it opened up, that center was exposed, and the edges, finally got exposed to the light at when it was fully open. And then as it went shut, that center was still exposed in light, but the edges of the photo were now not getting light. So every picture would be a little bit brighter in the center.
Okay.
And it would vignette, which means that it would be darker around the edges. What they're asking for is a focal plane shutter, which is built right over the... Well, obviously, right over the focal plane, which doesn't mean anything to you right now.
No, it means nothing to me.
It's a shutter that opens right at the place where the light is focusing, rather than forward from where the light is focusing. And so there's less, light things bouncing around between the shutter and the image processor. And the difference in this is this thing opened from left to right. It opened up on the left, and it opened up to the left, and it shut going to the left, which means that it would open up, and the entire image would be exposed to light. The entire image processor would be exposed to light, and then it would shut, and every single molecule of the image processor then was exposed to light for the exact same amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was revolutionary for cameras. I mean, when it happened. Because before this, it was that other type of shutter I was talking about that opens from the middle out and then back in. Or you would just take a thing off of the – you would just actually take a cover off of the camera and then put a cover back on it. And there was no – and that was your shutter. It was your hand or whatever.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So it made people with less skill a lot more – it made people with less skill at using a camera more capable of taking in focus good photos.
Right, because you don't have to do the shutter yourself. The shutter is automatic.
Right. You don't have to hold it very still and open it and close it, or even if it was automatic, you didn't have to deal with the different light things and the way that miniaturized stuff didn't work that well in 19 or in 1889, probably not even that well in the 40s. But so they're asking for a pretty good camera, and they're asking for a camera with a pretty big lens that lets a lot of light in, which to me just says that they probably are trying to do this by candlelight or just really low wattage electric lights in order to get the pictures to look good.
Do you think it's just, they're saying it here to make it sound more technical than it really is?
Kinda.
Meaning that when they made the script, they just decided, they're going to throw that down and that's it.
They're going to A-team the focal plane shutter in there. you know, the thing is, we don't really know at the time in the, this was made in the 60s?
63,
is
that yeah. accurate?
63. In 63, maybe focal plane shutter was something that people were aware of as being a fancy camera.
Uh-huh.
And so they threw it in there to make it sound like more like they knew what they were doing.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's fair. At this point, Werner has been given his assignment. He needs to find a camera with a focal plane shutter in order for him to get his wallet back and for him to not get in trouble at all. Basically, at this point, Henley...
Before we go on, for all the photographers out there that were screaming at the podcast just now, the name of that other kind of shutter is a leaf shutter. Okay, now we can go on. Okay.
Thank you. I wouldn't have noticed the difference, so that's fine. So, I mean, one of the things that I find really interesting about this whole scene is the whole time you have Blythe and Henley playing chess. Okay, so it got me starting to think, you know, like, what type of things did prisoners do in the camp in order to pass the time when they weren't digging tunnels? You know, like...
Well, yeah, that's kind of my question, too, because, I mean, we see chess pieces, we see him playing baseball, the guy's got the glove and the ball all the time.
We see characters playing with cards at some point. I think if I remember correctly, there's a place where someone plays checkers, right? So I decided...
Right. I'm thinking even the German people themselves during the war didn't have all that stuff.
So I decided to try and do a little bit of research to find out about sports in these type of camps. And I was very shocked to actually find a 24-page academic article called Anything But Ordinary, POW Sports in a Barbed Wire World. This was printed in the Journal of Sports History in 2007, and it was just fascinating. You wouldn't believe the things that they talked about. This is told more from an American perspective than the British perspective, but I think it's pretty much the same because of all the things that they actually had in, I mean, the camps that the British and American prisoners were mixed together. You know, they would still be getting them. Now, they basically, you know, in the book, they mentioned the game of volleyball, that characters would, the prisoners would play volleyball in their spare time. And according to this article, there were 95,000 American POWs in German camps during the war, which is a really, really large amount. I never would have thought that there was close to 100,000 prisoners at this point. 33,000 of them were pilots that were shot down. Okay, this particular camp that they were in, Stalag Luft 3, they had a football field. They had several baseball fields. They had softball diamonds. They had basketball courts. They had a perimeter track that ran a half mile. And one of the things that this article discusses, one of the things that this article mentions is that a lot of these prisoners were in very good health and shape when they were repatriated because they had so much access to all of these sports materials, facilities.
That's the exact opposite of what I would do if I was a prisoner of war, I think.
Yeah. But the question is what else did they have to do? They can, you know, as we've seen scenes where they're gardening dirt, you know. So if you're given an opportunity to sit and play sports, you know, that would be fine. Now, then the question remains, okay, where did they get equipment for all of these sports? A lot of it came from the YMCA. The YMCA, they put out a report in 1945 after the end of the war that they were able to ship via the Red Cross 1,754,254 sports articles to prisoner of war camps. Okay, we're talking nearly 2 million articles of sports material, okay?
In just a few years.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's a huge number, even if you're just counting every ping pong ball that they sent over. You know, they sent over footballs and hockey sticks and jerseys and elastic bandages, balls, gloves, figure skates, pucks, sabers, epis, masks for people who were... You know, who were into fencing. They sent over golf irons. They sent over horseshoes for them to play horseshoes. If anyone has seen Stalag 17, there's a very pivotal scene where the characters are playing horseshoes. They sent them repair kits for a lot of their sports equipment. They sent them shoelaces. I mean, they even had sports officers in the camps. You know, they had like the guy in charge of all the sporting equipment. It amazes me the amount of people and articles of sports equipment that these camps had. I mean, you're thinking prisoner of war camp, you wouldn't think that these are sports recreation facilities, but they were.
Yeah, they sound like the Parks and Rec.
Exactly.
Of any town.
Exactly.
They've got all these fields for it. They had a golf. They had a golf course.
Yes. Yes. So
that's at the real life camp that this movie is about. They had a golf.
Yes. Okay.
And 18 holes. Not
one second. We'll get there. Now some of the equipment they didn't let the sports officer would keep hidden or would keep locked up because they were afraid that things would break via wear and tear, and then they wouldn't have them anymore. They also feared that sometimes, you know, if a ball goes through a window and breaks the window, so the Germans weren't going to replace the window. So, you know, they needed to be real careful about what damage they were doing to the camp. They had cricket teams. They had soccer teams. They had rugby teams. A side note, this article mentions the fact that, you know, in the winter, the prisoners would have snowball fights that would turn into real fights. You know, there was a lot of exercise that they all got. You know, they also had to worry about hitting the ball over the fence. So they would have a special flag that a prisoner would wave as he was going over the areas of the fence or wherever he was allowed to go to pick up the ball so that he wouldn't get shot. Even though there were some sadistic guards that still shot prisoners that were going to retrieve balls.
Even if they had a flag?
Yeah, even if they had a flag. There were 10,000 POWs in Stalag Luft III, then in and of itself. 2,000 of them were a part of 200 baseball teams that they had in the compound. In professional baseball, right now, what is there? There's 34 teams, if I remember correctly? Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
In one POW camp, they had 200 teams. It's just...
Well, okay, so I have a question about that. Does it mean they had 200 competing teams at one time, or does it mean that this week we're calling ourselves Johnson's Raiders, and next week a slightly different configuration of those guys are calling themselves the POWs or whatever?
No, these were different teams for every season that they would make up. They would say, okay, we have a... 10-week season, a 3-month season, whatever it is, and they would split up into 200 different teams. They had newspapers.
Wow.
They had newspapers in the camp that would have their standings and box scores and individual statistics of who the leaders were in the particular camp. Okay, the German commandant would show up at some of the games. And he would show his way of cheering by beating his cane against his boots in order to, you know, to not really cheer along with everybody else. In this camp, they had two leagues where there were 400 prisoners playing basketball. Okay, they had ice hockey. They would create their own ice hockey rinks they would take water from the fire pool, and put it where they would you know wait for it to freeze over, and then they would be able to have ice skating. They actually had one year where they had to cancel the season because they had too many sticks that got broken in the middle of the fights during the game. Okay, they had volleyball teams. They had soccer teams. There's a quote that's saying that the Americans who tried playing European soccer, they were able to provide more laughs than a Bob Hope program because it was just so comical for the Brits to look at them. In Stalag 17, they had a miniature golf course. Okay? And in Stalag Luft 3, they had a 9-hole golf course. And some of the golf clubs were altered hockey sticks, which were also provided by the YMCA. They actually had an exclusive country club in the camp that was known as Four. F-O-R-E. That's what they called the thing. they would actually, they use the golf course in order to hide sand while they were tunneling. You know, they have their sand traps. So they would come and they would bring sand from their digging and put them in the, you know, in the sand traps, which is quite clever to do that. They had a track and field area in Stalaglyph 3, which they had places to do the high jump. They had the 1,000 or 2,000 yard run. They would have a 100 yard race to find out the fastest man race. Obviously, the Germans didn't allow them to have a pole vaulting campaign. that would be a little counterproductive.
They'd let them have baseball bats, but not pole vault. Yeah,
exactly.
You can have all the, like 20,000 prisoners could overcome us with baseball bats and golf clubs and hockey sticks and stuff, but you're not allowed to pole vault because you might go over the fence.
Yes.
Skis were just so weird back then. Yeah.
They would actually, the YMCA or veterans groups or whatever, would actually smuggle things in these sports equipments. They would smuggle in radio parts and camera parts inside baseballs. They would hollow out baseballs and put parts in so that when you got the whole bag of baseballs inside, when you opened it up, you had a treat. You had, you know, you had a camera that was broken up into a whole bunch of different parts. The handles of the ping pong paddles and the baseball bats. Also, they would hollow them out and put stuff in there also. I mean, this is just so fascinating. Because this is something that I've never thought of before.
I've never given that any thought either. So, you know, they're smuggling in equipment. They're smuggling in maps. They're smuggling in stuff. All because, like they said in the movie, it's their duty to escape. That was real life then.
Yes, completely. This is probably among the most fascinating things I found. And I'm not a sports fan. But the idea that you know, that about how much of this was going on in the camp is just mind-boggling. Fascinating at the same time. And so basically we're at the last point of this minute. Henley gives his favorite line, one of my favorite lines, that after Werner leaves the room, he goes, "Ah, he's a crazy mixed-up kid, that Werner. But I still like him."
You know, I was surprised to learn, I don't know if you have discussed this before, but this Robert Graf, this guy that played Werner, he was actually in the army. He was actually in the German army.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
He was. Okay. You guys have discussed this.
No. Go ahead. Discuss it.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
I just found this little tidbit about him. He was conscripted into the Wehrmacht, and he was sent to the Eastern Front, though just the worst place to be in World War II.
Which is why he's German. Which is why his character, you know, was scared about going to the Eastern Front, because he knew what it was like.
He got wounded near the end of the war in 1944, and so when he came back, he got assigned to like war production duties in Munich, where he ended up studying theater, and that's how he ended up being an actor in the first place, and how he ended up in this movie. He married the actress Selma Erfer, and was the father of the... He was the father... One of his children was Dominic Graf, who made... I didn't look this up, sorry to say.
Who made a documentary about his father.
Right. That's what it was. It was just amazing to me. You know, in this day and age, I don't think if someone was in the German army, they would give him a job. If they, you know, right after the war, I mean, he died of cancer,
right? This is 20 years later.
But we have people just, you know, not being able to live stuff down from 20 years ago in modern times.
Right.
But, you know, back then it was more about the art than the person. It makes me wonder, you know, someone coming from the German army, like how into the sort of, you know, bad things that you did that this guy was. I'm not trying to put any shade on him. He was an amazing part of this.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, he passed away not long after this movie came out.
Yeah, cancer.
He died at the age of 42, 3 years after this movie came out.
Right? I mean, he was just a kid.
Well,
I mean, in the Army, he was just, you know, just a kid. And he...
Well, that's what they say, but I mean, as we just said, Henley calls him a kid, but he's... Yeah. It's funny, he's actually older than James Garner. He's like almost 10 years older than James Garner, and Garner calls him a kid.
He would be, wouldn't he?
Yeah. All right, so Curtis, you have anything else to say about this minute?
Oh, you know, I could go on and on about the lighting and everything, but I think we're... It seems to be feeling like it needs to wrap up.
I'm not trying to wrap it up. If you have something interesting that you want people to hear, then by all means.
Oh, I pick things apart.
Isn't that what we do by minute podcast?
Yeah. No, I just find it, you know, I don't really have much more to say about it. I just find it incredibly fascinating that the Germans were so into cooperating and taking care of American prisoners, considering what they were doing in the other camps. That just seems like a different, you know, a different set of people doing that.
No, but that's how this portrayed in the movie. I mean, in the real story, the guards were a little more sadistic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, it based on what's written in the book, it doesn't reach the proportions of things that happened, you know, in the death camps.
Right.
And stuff like that.
And I understand the difference between,
you know, you also have to take into consideration, what type of German soldiers are being sent to be the guards.
Sure.
In these particular camps.
Yeah.
You know, these are not the elite of the elites.
Yeah, they'd be on the front, huh?
They'd be either on the front or in some place a little more important than guarding, you know, thousands of Allied prisoners.
I just wonder how, you know, what am I trying to say? The Americans' attitude in this movie were just real jovial. All the prisoners are super jovial. In real life, that probably wasn't the case, but it almost seems like a fun place to be. People are coming out more fit, which, as we know now in modern times, leads to better mental health. It almost seems like a vacation when they weren't getting beat up or shot.
And it also gives people, you know, more, if it's better for mental health, then therefore it's easier for them to think about how they're going to try and escape.
I would also think that, you know, if they're healthy and they feel better, they're also easier to take care of from the German perspective. If you have a bunch of people that are miserable all the time, it would just be, you know, trying to get them to do anything would just be a constant pain versus having healthy people. You know, when you're healthy, you cooperate more, you take more crap from people when you're healthy. You're kind of like, ah, yeah.
Yes.
But anyway, man, I love this movie. This movie is amazing. And I'm so glad that you are.
What
go on.
What's your... No, I was going to say, what's your history with the movie? We haven't discussed that. When did you first see this?
I've seen it three times altogether in my life. I don't have a clear memory of the first time. What's that?
That's it. Wow.
Yeah.
No, I'm surprised. You're talking so enthusiastically about this movie. That's great. But, you know, you made it sound as if you've seen it more often than that.
You know, the first time I saw it, I was young. And I was really into... Let's see, how did this work? I was really into Hogan's Heroes. I loved that as a sitcom when I was a kid. And my dad was like, oh, you should see this movie then. And I watch it and kind of with that Hogan's Heroes mindset in mind while I was watching it, I really enjoyed it. It's like, oh, this would be like the real Hogan's Heroes. This is how it would have really happened. Right?
Exactly. Well, this is this and they based Hogan's Heroes on this and on Stalag 17, more on Stalag 17, but there are elements from this movie and this story that also, you know, transferred over.
That and when I was a kid, it was kind of my first grown-up movie, you know, in terms of, it wasn't a kid plot. It was kind of a grown-up plot. And, you know, I was young. I mean, I'm saying, you know, I was six, 7 years old the first time I saw this movie. So it was kind of So I was kind of proud of myself for like sticking with this adult movie and getting it and enjoying it and getting the humor and everything that happened in it. And also it was fascinating to me, you know, the whole tunnel digging thing. This is when I'm a kid still. This is the first time I'm watching it. The whole tunnel digging thing, the engineering thing was just, I just loved it. I just, you know, replayed it in my mind all the time. You have to keep in mind, I'm saying I only watched this three times because what happened is we didn't have the ability to just watch it all the time. It just had to come on TV, you know, when I was that young. So I watched it once, you know, and I watched The Guns of Navarone once, and I watched Kelly's Heroes once. And then, you know, years and years later, when I was in my 20s and 30s, it's like, I'm going to revisit these movies. I'm going to watch these movies again. And I kind of went through a phase of watching The Great Escape and Kelly's Heroes and all those great movies, you know, the Dirty Dozen, all those things over again. And then I guess I could watch it about four times because I watched it one other time after I met my wife. I kind of wanted to show her the movie because she had never seen it. And then I watched it one more time with you. But the fact that I've only watched it four times, I'm super enthusiastic about this movie. I just, you know, yeah.
Seriously, that's great.
This movie is just, I don't know. It's just one of those movies. It's kind of like Kelly's Heroes. There's just things in this movie that kind of live in my head all the time. I'll just, you know, be reminded of when I see something happen in real life.
Yeah, when someone trips you up and instead of speaking German, you say something in English.
When that kind of thing happened, yeah. I'm trying to escape from Germany, like, for sure. Those were dark days, but yes. Definitely lived in my head in those days.
Exactly, or when you get blackmailed into, you know, having to give someone a camera.
All of the things, yeah.
All right. Well, do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
I don't know. You know, really, I troll around. Here's how you get in touch with me. Go to Linktree, which is linktr.ee. Linktree/Curtis Play is my name, which is also spelled weird, so you can't find me there either. But it's CurtisBlows, like blows. Curtis Blows. Linktree/Curtis Blows. And that takes you to everything that I am. All of my email addresses, my photography stuff, all my podcast stuff, just everywhere. But in about a month, after this one airs, we are launching the Time Bandits Minute. That is, that's the movie from 1981 about time bandits. I'm saying that weird, but I'm really proud of the work we're doing there. Just had Rob on, you know, like last week to talk about it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I want you guys to come here.
Yeah, I had fun on my three episodes, so you know, I can't wait for that to come out next month. Yeah. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher that you might be using to listen to this show. You can send me an email, thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler, and our Twitter account is GreatEscapeMXM. So thank you once again, Curtis, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It was a lot of fun.
And it was a lot of fun talking to you again, too.
All right. Excellent. Until tomorrow, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
Tally-ho. Tally-ho.
Oh, my God. I forgot. Tally-ho.